From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
Jason, I arrived on time unexpectedly because it rained in Perth this morning. And
what? It rained?
It did rain, yes. And so consequently, everybody forgot how to drive.
That does happen in Perth because it happens so infrequently.
Yeah, especially after a dry spell, the first rain, everybody just... I don't know what it is, but it's a fairly uniquely Perth phenomenon. So I'm just pleased that I was able to get here on time this morning.
Yeah, so Perth. Yeah, well, I'm glad that you're here on time as well, because we do have a very special guest today. She is senior lecturer at the University of Queensland and is hugely knowledgeable on the subject of psych health and safety. Many in the Australian safety profession would know her as the author of the OHS Body of Knowledge chapter on psychological hazards. And she's a key contributor to the Australian Institute of Health and Safety position paper on psychological health and safety at work. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kirsten Way.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming along. It's, amazing to have you on. I was mentioning to you off air, I first read the position paper a few months back, and I just thought this is so bang on point. I need to have the author on. And so we had to do some investigation because your name wasn't on the paper. But we found out it was you, and we're really delighted to have you on today to have a chat about that position paper and all things psych health and safety.
Thanks, Jason. And I should also acknowledge that other people who were in the working party that put that together, so Carlo Caponiccia and also Peter Miller, and then a number of people within AIHS as well.
Oh, that's nice of you to share that. We've had Carlo on episode 5 already, so we weren't going to have him back to talk about the position paper. We'll have him on again at some point soon, hopefully. But it's really great to be able to talk to you today about your work in this field.
Looking forward to it.
All right, Kirsten, before we get started on the serious stuff, we like to ask people what they're listening to, podcasts, etc.
Oh, wow. So... I'm in Brisbane and we're in lockdown at the moment, and so much of my podcast listening is when I'm travelling, driving in the car. But the two that I really love, and this is, I guess, my org psych background, is Guy Raz's How I Built This, which talks about entrepreneurs and starting from scratch and how they built their companies. I think it's always incredibly interesting, and their resilience and hard work and some of the things they get through to get there, I love. But he's also got another one that's great, I think, called Wisdom from the Top, which is a similar thing, but interviewing leaders and CEOs around the world, some really famous ones about their trajectory to leadership positions. So, yeah, I love those. I think they're really good.
Yeah, I love Guy Raz. I love How I Built This, but I actually did not know about Wisdom from the Top, so I'll have to
get that one out. It's a more recent one, yeah. And you'll recognise some of the CEOs he interviews. It's it's good.
Yeah. Good. We like to get some different ones coming up, don't we?
Yeah, I've written that one down, yep. So I'll check that one out.
All right. Can you tell us about your professional career?
Wow, okay. So... my first degree was occupational therapy, and so my first job when I graduated from occupational therapy was actually a graduate position in the WHS regulator. So I was working predominantly in human factors and ergonomics, but I'd done a year of psychology before I did OT, and then kept doing my psychology degree during my OT degree. So by the time I graduated, I only had a year left of my psych undergrad, which I kept doing part-time while I was working in those health and safety roles, human factors and ergonomics roles, and so became registered as a psychologist in around 2000, and then went on to do my org psych endorsement. And during that period, it was an evolution within health and safety, I guess. When I first started in health and safety, I remember the director of the health and safety regulator saying to me, Kirsten, psych It's nothing to do with health and safety, nothing to do with business. That's a community health issue and not a workplace issue. So what a transition there's been in, you know, that 25 or so years. And it was around 2000 or so when I was working with the regulator when they started saying, actually, people do have an obligation under the health and safety legislation. So I was lucky to be in the front seat there and started one of the first psych units within a regulator and having to really think about how industry should be thinking about this problem from a health and safety obligations perspective. And it was around about that time that I went and worked for the Health and Safety Executive in the UK as well with Peter Kelly. Jason and I were just talking about him before in their health directorate. And so that was around about the time that the management standards were being developed and also lots of their guidance on stress in workplaces. So I was really lucky to be able to be there at that time and learn from the UK experience. And then, of course, when you're overseas, you're thinking about what's going to be happening next. So I decided to come back and start a PhD, as you do. And I did my PhD very much setting up the industry partnership for people at work, which is the psychosocial hazards risk assessment tool that the regulators around Australia. And it was born out of my strategic work in the regulator acknowledging, well, if we're going to ask industry to do something about this, they need to be able to measure it first. They need to be able to do a risk assessment so that they can target their risk controls to the areas that are actually creating harm. Without that, then they're all just, you know, shooting in the dark. So that's where that project stemmed from and kind of was the massive team of people that were working on that. My PhD ended up being a small component of that, looking at supervisor responses to conflict and whether the supervisor makes it better or worse, basically, for people's psychological well-being. And so once I finished my PhD, I went and worked in the policy area within health and safety, so senior policy writing government legislation and policy positions for health and safety general and also workers' compensation regulation, but was always thinking, oh, maybe the academic life is the thing for me. And so I stayed in that role for about 2 years and then ended up taking a full-time role in academia. At that stage, in a business school looking after, as the discipline lead for OHS, so looking after the masters in OHS, but psychological health and safety and psychological well-being was always my research area. So then I came back to UQ in the School of Psychology, which I'm loving and feel very privileged to be there to work with so many smart and inspiring academics. It's wonderful. Sorry, that was long.
No, it's good. It's good. You've had a really interesting and I think diverse career path, which is always good for some of our early career professionals to hear about, you know, the different pathways into this field of work. So what are you working on at the moment?
Oh, so many things, too many things. I think that's one of the double-edged swords of academia. There's so many interesting things to be involved in, but probably the ones that I'm leading that are closest to my heart is I'm working on a big project looking at supervisor competencies for return to work after a psychological injury. So what do supervisors need to be good at if we're going to have better return to work and remain at work outcomes for people with a psychological injury, because they're critical in that role. And looking at being able to develop a self-assessment tool that supervisors can use themselves if they've got someone who's psychologically unwell, like what's their strengths and weaknesses that they can build on, and as well that orgs might be able to use more globally to identify either where they want to place people or what the development needs are across their line managers in relation to this space. So that one, really interesting project looking at complainants' experience of making a report to health and safety regulators for psychological health and wellbeing. So when they make a complaint, what's their experience of, does it make it better? Does it make it worse? Does it achieve an outcome that they want to achieve? What's their sense of justice associated with it? What's their justice motives associated with it? So I've got a PhD student who's doing some really interesting work on justice motives and whether people are seeking retribution when they when these things happen, when these transgressions happen, or are they have they been able to move on so that they're looking for motivated by a more restorative or reintegrative kind of approach. So that one's really interesting. I'm doing some work with the AIHS actually on better defining the competencies required for OHS professionals working in psych. And then some just really interesting general human factors, cognitive ergonomics issues around automation in mining, but as well how that changes some of the teamwork aspects if they're working in autonomous systems versus traditional systems. And that's probably only the beginning. You could see behind my computer, I've got post-it notes of all the projects that I'm working on, and there's literally about 20, too many, but they're all, yeah, really interesting. Lots of interesting stuff about workability for aging workers, the stigmatisation and devaluation of aged care workers that I've got some PhD students working on as well.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot. You're a busy woman, so I think we can be extra pleased that we managed to find some time with you.
Yeah, talk about cognitive demands.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Often the research says that cognitive demands have a great a positive impact on people's psychological well-being. So cognitive demands is one of those ones that's a bit.
Just so many topics, though. If you're going down one area, sure, but you have that mental agility to go from one kind of subject.
But they're all pretty much related to psychological well-being associated with work in some aspect.
Yeah. We'll let you have that one. You are the expert. All right, great. Well, you mentioned, and we mentioned the introduction about the AIHS position paper on psych health and safety at work. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that, starting with maybe, you know, what was the driver to create that?
Yeah. So this is interesting because I've had the lived experience of working in this area for so long, when we first started, one of the biggest challenges was about raising awareness within industry and as well just helping employers to understand that they had obligations and that it wasn't something that was purely a community health issue. I think the problem now is quite different. It's actually that there's almost too many players in the space. And a lot of people who have started working in the workplace space that are coming at it from clinical backgrounds. So clinical psychologists, psychiatrists who have a very loud reach because there's a lot of them, and they've got a lot of really important things to say, absolutely important, but they're coming at it from a clinical perspective, and so they're coming at it in terms of bolstering coping and helping individuals either who are unwell or in individuals who are improving their flourishing. So these are all really important things, but what the AIHS acknowledged, and I think what most of us who work in this area who've come at it from a org psych or OHS perspective acknowledge, is that that's not something that's going to meet employers' duties in relation to health and safety, but more importantly, it's not going to prevent harm. It's not going to address the source of the harm. So it's, I guess there's eight key things that the Institute acknowledged about the need for this position statement. One was organisations are still tending to focus on individual level rather than systemic level interventions. There's a focus on mental health promotion and awareness activities. Again, I'm not for a second saying they're not important, but there's not a concomitant focus on addressing the sources of harm, and that's a big problem. There's a lack of awareness about the potential and wide-ranging sources of hazards and how they interact. There's some inadequate skills in risk assessment in relation to this area, and also almost a lack of confidence, or there's an opportunity for improving people's confidence in, you know, really putting their foot forward in this approach, given how sometimes the stigmatisation, mental health awareness voices that comes from other parts of the sector. So how can people with these skills, with confidence, say, this is important, this is really important, and here's a position paper that helps justify the importance of work design and those higher order controls. The fifth one is about all the different terms out there, all the different terminology, and how frustrating that can be, and how, I can't tell you how many meetings I've sat in where that's almost been taken over, actually doing something. You know, all this discussion about what are we going to call it? And so I think having a position paper that just says, this is the language to use from an OHS perspective, it's not at all to say that people coming from a clinical perspective aren't going to be using different language, but just recognising and signposting that there is this different language, and this is the language that's used in the space of prevention and OHS. That lots of employers are still confused about where their obligations start and stop in relation to psychological health and safety or mental health. And so helping, I guess, give OHS professionals the confidence to be able to say, sure, there's this proportion of mental health that's related to the community prevalence of mental health, but we know that around 15% of work-related, of mental health can be attributed to work. And this is what employers have an obligation to manage, and this is what OHS professionals should be helping stamp out. And then lastly, I think safety science has gone through a real evolution in terms of theory and practice, and it started from this like almost accident proneness personality factors that drive safety behaviours, and has really evolved through to understanding that individuals are behaviours sit within a system and they're not separate from the system. And that evolution of safety science and what that brings, I think, is not something that people who are trained in individual clinical therapy that have a loud voice in industry can, they don't bring that to the same extent that people who have either org psych or safety or human factors and ergonomics or occupational therapy type backgrounds. And so, again, having that in a position paper just allows them to have a greater voice in that space and be able to be backed up, I guess, by the professional association. Whew, that was another long answer.
Yeah, well, that was pretty much the whole position paper in summary, which is terrific.
What drove it? So, but you're right. What drove it obviously influences what's actually included in it.
Yeah, no, Joelle will definitely put in the show notes the link to the position paper so that people can read it. It is great that it is really concise, so people can read. It's not a hugely lengthy document, which wouldn't get read. So it's hugely practical, I find.
Which is probably also a significant achievement when you're working on a document with a number of co-authors to get it to a point where it is actually succinct and quite practical.
Yeah.
Well done there.
The other thing I think that's important with this is the timeliness of it. I'm sure you're aware that there's been a number of reviews of the national legislation that have identified real gaps in terms of psychological health and safety in terms of the regulatory framework, the legislative frameworks. And so, of course, governments are likely to be responding to those recommendations and inquiring into how they can do better in this space. So, if there can be consistency in terminology and language amongst any guidance and documentation that comes out from the various health and safety regulators, that'll be a really good thing too.
Yeah, especially for those organisations that do sort of have operations in different jurisdictions. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, we see a lot of drivers coming online this year, obviously with hopefully some changes to the WHS Act to incorporate more around psychological health and safety. Obviously, the global ISO standard on psychological safety at work is due any time now in the coming months. So that obviously is important. But interestingly, the Productivity Commission inquiry into mental health out of five priority areas for reform, one of them was to elevate psychological health and safety to the same level as physical health and safety, which must have been music to your ears.
It is. I think, it's interesting in the health and safety legislation, the duties in relation to physical and psych have always been there, and in that psychological health is mentioned in the scope of all the health and safety legislative frameworks around the country. But I think in practice what often happens is that organisations in their decision making kind of have it on their risk registers, and then it just kind of, you know, flounders there because there's a focus on the more, high impact or immediate impact hazards. So I think there's a lot more industry and community movement in that space. So I think many organisations are really treating it a lot more seriously these days than even they were 5 years ago. So I think that's, it is a very good thing.
Yeah. So with the position paper, you outlined the eight main areas. What is the main hope for the position paper?
I think it would be great. I'm not naive enough to think that we'll ever get to a point where we're all using exactly the same terminology, because people are coming at it from different backgrounds and frameworks. But it would be great if there was less confusion around that and more consistency. I think it would be great if OHS professionals can just with confidence talk a bit more about how harm occurs and really what are the main psychosocial hazards they should be focusing on in workplaces, and that all risk assessment and risk control is centred around those in a holistic and consultative way.
Yeah. If we can just have, people who are organising safety conferences to not include people talking about psychological safety, just go has safety in the title, that would be great. Yeah, there is a lot of confusion and consistent terminology, I think, is going to be one of the key things that we need to focus on.
So the other thing that you've written there's so many things that you've written. The other one that we're going to talk about today was the chapter that you contributed to the body of knowledge on psychosocial hazards. So can you tell us a bit about how, is there an interaction between the concepts in the position paper and the concepts in the body of knowledge chapter?
Yeah, so definitely, because the position paper is very much talking about this is the terminology that should be used, this is an understanding for OHS professionals about how harm occurs, the primary importance of good work design and taking an integrative approach. But it also has a component in there about the role of OHS professionals in relation to psych. The body of knowledge then really goes on and articulates in detail. The whole purpose of it is to articulate what the minimum level of knowledge, skills and abilities should be for generalist OH professionals across all hazards. So this is the chapter that defines what it should be for psych hazards in particular. Fundamentally important in better articulating where that role starts and stops, I guess. Because like all hazards that generalist health and safety professionals deal with, they're specialists. So they're specialists in hygiene, they're specialists in ergonomics, specialists in noise, and they're specialists in psychosocial hazards. So knowing what the minimum they should be able to do and then when they need to get help from those specialists.
Okay. Well, can you, for those OHS generalists who might be listening and who are keen to learn more, can you give us a bit of a summary of what they should be looking to develop?
Yeah, so I think it focuses around those key issues really that's in the position paper in some ways, but then it obviously goes on in a lot more depth. So, you know, what is work-related mental health? What is a psychological injury? How does it occur? What's the mechanisms for how work translates or creates hazards that may result in a stress response that then, if it's prolonged and exacerbated, results in health outcomes or behavioural changes? So what's that pathway and what's the mechanisms for what's happening in the body and in the mind that's creating those risks? So not only for psychological health outcomes but also for physical health outcomes, because psychosocial hazards, we know, can create both. But then I guess it really focuses in on explaining this is what the literature says we know are the work factors that are more likely to create those stress responses and therefore those health outcomes. So if you can have a good understanding about where to focus your risk assessment based on the known psychosocial hazards, then the risk controls can be better matched to those, and therefore you can help advise organisations about what's reasonably practicable for them to manage the risk.
Excellent. And does the chapter include advice on sort of what other professions or departments they should be collaborating with in this space?
Yeah, it does. So it acknowledges that there's specialists in this space, but also that there's many others that have a different role, I guess, that's complementary or that sits alongside the IHS professionals. And in my experience, it can be quite different in different organisations. So in particular, what the HR professional does versus the IHS professional, there can be some variation in that. And that's not necessarily a problem, I don't think. But it is important that people are clear on their roles. So, and then also IR professionals are often involved in the mix as well, return to work, and then health practitioners that are actually supporting individual workers. So, yeah, it does talk about that and acknowledges that there's definitely, like all health and safety hazards, experts to call in certain circumstances.
Yeah, fantastic. I sort of tend to think about this particular field as a Venn diagram of, you know, and there's crossover of multiple sort of areas of specialization and areas of responsibility within an organization. And it's really a matter of getting a good understanding of the different the different positions and functions that need to be involved, but a good comprehensive approach.
And a really good practical example of when I've seen that work well is the OHS professional champions a risk assessment process for psychosocial hazards, and in the context of that they may set up a steering committee where they draw in on expertise about change management and also all comms that might come from other parts of the business or from external experts. They roll it out, they get the diagnosis in or the risk assessment in, and then they get assistance in either interpreting it or in implementing it. So, for example, what I've seen is an organisation might get their risk assessment results that show the psychosocial hazards in this part of the business are XYZ, and they're all pretty non-controversial work design type controls that need to be implemented in that part of the business. But in some teams, there's high reports of bullying, interpersonal conflict, abusive supervision, for example, and these are the things that are creating the psychosocial hazards for that particular work group. And then, for example, they might get in an organisational psychologist or someone with real specific facilitative skills where they can talk to the individuals involved in an informed and professional way and a safe way as well. And as well, I've seen it work well when there's particular bullying complaints, for example, that have IR overlaps or other HR overlaps that they work really closely with people who have specific expertise in investigating those interpersonal conflict issues, which are sometimes different to your traditional OHS investigations. Yeah,
yeah, very different.
So with OHS generalists, do you have any suggestions for what they should be upskilling in or where they can go to get upskilled?
Yeah, so I think this is another area where potentially the position paper and the body of knowledge chapter are quite helpful, in that they can identify whether providers are providing training that is consistent with that, or whether they're providing training that's coming more from a clinical or health perspective. And I think that's not that kind of training isn't a useful adjunct, it is, but it's not the core skills that they need, and indeed want to make sure that they're not being diverted away from the core role of the OHS profession, which is primary prevention and good work design and understanding the broader systemic issues in relation to psychosocial hazards. So I think being really critically appraising the training providers, whether they're coming from the background that they need, or whether they're coming from one of the other areas that work in this space, and is going to be taking them down the wrong path, I guess, in terms of their individual knowledge, skills and abilities.
Yeah, no, we have seen that before, where some OHS people have started to go down the illness path and, you know, feel like they need to understand every single, you know, illness that's listed in the DSM-5, for example.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And that's just not their core function as an OHS professional.
That's right. So I think if they understand that, they just need to focus on, you know, psych hazards and identifying and monitoring those, not even necessarily controlling them, right, because they can bring experts in for that. I think that they'd be much better off. Are you aware of any programs that OHS generalists can use or are available within Australia?
There's a number of universities, ours included, that offers a Master of Business Psychology that doesn't require psychology undergraduate degree, and it's kind of a mixture of business and psychology, and it doesn't aim to create psychologists. It's very much saying this is not about registration as a psychologist, but an important area of knowledge, skills and abilities that people are often seeking in relation to business psychology. I know there's various universities have different focuses on health and safety in that space. Most of the Masters of OHS degrees have a small component on this. And again, they just vary depending on you know, what's the expertise of the academic staff that are teaching them, I think. So there are things out there, definitely, most of them at the master's level. And some of the masters have stepped, like graduate certificates, graduate diplomas, that's kind of step you through. But it's probably going to be a matter of just, looking at them all and seeing what they cover in relation to some of these things that are in the position statement.
Yeah. One of our Canadian guests mentioned that there was an online certificate level, I think, course that health and safety professionals could use.
Yeah, okay.
It's a psychosocial safety advisor, I think it was. So a certificate.
Ah, it's a Canadian one, is it?
A Canadian institution, yeah.
Interesting,
online. So that was Bob Stenhouse, wasn't it?
Yeah, he might have mentioned one to us, yeah.
Yeah,
so you're not aware of anything that's being developed in Australia that's similar?
No, I'm not. I'm just racking my brains for if I I'm not specifically about that. So within some master's programs, for example, there's individual units on psychological health and safety or health and safety within a psych master's. So it's just, but they're all quite different. And the Canadian, it's interesting that's a Canadian one. There's some important differences in the Canadian standard to the Australian context. So, again, it would just be making sure that, you know, there was some crossover this or some, you know, acknowledgement of how it's different.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was just interested while we had you to see if you're aware of anything because, you know, while master's levels degrees are great, they're obviously time and cost intensive.
Yeah.
And if we want a health and safety profession to really adopt psych health and safety, then that's probably a large barrier for entry.
That's right. And the project that we're doing with AIHS, we've got a master's students working on competencies for OHS professionals for psych, but really trying to tease that out in more detail. I think that will form a useful basis for this exact issue. I think the challenge for, as is the case for most hazards, most OHS professionals would do a generalist degree where they get a bit of everything. And then if they do want to specialise, then they do often go off and do like a master's in occupational hygiene or a master's in ergonomics, or in this case, the thing that would be most available would be a master's in business psychology. So you're right, like it'd be lovely if there was some micro-credentialing on the way.
Like a grad cert or something would be quite achievable that someone who's a generalist could do so that they've got that capacity, but it doesn't involve the same level of sort of commitment and intensity as a full master's degree.
Yeah, that's right.
Because that lack of competency is just such a large barrier. Like if we hope for the Productivity Commission's key reform area that psych health and safety be elevated to the same level as physical health and safety, the competency just isn't there.
Yeah, that's right.
There needs to be some easy way to bring up the profession in that area. A master's degree.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that the master's student that's working on this with me is looking at too, like how much of health and safety professionals' competency or desire to work in this area is influenced by either knowledge, skills and abilities or confidence, and how much is it about not wanting to work in an area where there's a lot of emotional labour? How much of it is a choice in a way that they're not choosing to go into it? But I think there's less and less opportunity for choice because it's just becoming more and more of a central part of any business's OHS risk management systems that can't be avoided, I think.
Yeah, I think potentially that perception of significant emotional labour is maybe not all that accurate either. And I think
I agree.
It comes from the lack of knowledge that, you know, because that clinical model has really been the primary model that people have thought about from a mental health perspective, you know, you've got OHS practitioners thinking about psych health and safety, and they're thinking that they're going to have to be counsellors.
Absolutely. I really agree with that, Joelle. Like, if you look at the true role of the OHS professional and primary prevention, it is around diagnosing it at the group level and implementing controls at the group level. So, sure, there's individual complaints that perhaps have to be responded to, but usually that's when they'd be drawing in other experts. If it was a really emotionally laden situation, that's probably a sign that I would be suggesting they should be getting help.
Yep.
From experts.
So I guess speaking as a representative of the AIHS, what does the safety industry view as critical in relation to psych health and safety?
Yeah, okay. So I should probably say I don't really speak as a representative. Well, I'm a member, but
some insight then. We'll put it
that way. sorry, and the question was
So what would the safety industry see as critical in relation to psych health and safety?
Yeah, okay. I think what would be really great is if we could get to a place where line managers, when a worker comes to them and says, I'm struggling, they do all the things that they're already doing around connecting them to support, but the thing that's looming almost larger in their mind is, what work am I asking them to do that might be able to be altered, that may be influencing that? I still think that it's still too much of a powerful first thought process that businesses and line managers go to individual level support. I think it's such a fundamental thing, and it's disheartening sometimes when the people who are professionals working in this space reinforce that. And again, I always want to qualify this, because that is important. It is absolutely important. But it just breaks my heart when it's not concomitantly recognised that the source of harm isn't dealt with. I think if we could get there, you know, massive neural pathway to control the source of harm.
Yeah,
support or even people, but control the source of harm.
Yep. And if the source of harm is external to work, then it's maybe saying, hey, how about you take some time off, or, you know, reduce your hours for a little while.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess
The demands from the job perspective, so that people have got the capacity to deal with the demands from their home life during that.
Yeah, that's right. And I guess when I say that about control the source of harm, I'm talking about work. Control the work-related source of harm. Then I think many businesses and line managers aren't even there yet, let alone non-work sources of harm.
Yeah. Or there may be more willingness to recognise non-work sources.
That's right. That's right. Kind of, phew, it's not our problem.
Yeah, well, Psych Health and Safety surely has come a long way since that state regulator was mentioning to you that psychology has no place in health and safety. Yeah,
that's right.
And obviously big drivers coming online this year as well, which hopefully we'll see another advance forward for the field. So what are your hopes for the future of Psych Health and Safety?
Unfortunately, I feel like we're going to still be talking about this issue in 20 years' time. And perhaps that's not an admission of any kind of failure. I think it's just an acknowledgement that line managers are constantly coming into roles new, and they need to learn to develop the skills in how their decisions in the design and management of work and how they interact with their workers can create hazards. So I would love to see this being a central thing in MBA degrees, in business degrees, anything that's teaching managers, because it's really not at the moment, or it's a little sad add-on, whereas to me it's a fundamentally important thing, both in terms of work wellbeing, but also in terms of productivity and business success. So if managers can be better at this, then I think it will make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I guess the OB content of the MBA curriculum probably hasn't changed significantly for quite some time. So that's probably a pretty easy area. Well, she says naively.
Obvious area.
Yeah. An obvious area to address, but easy is probably not the right word to use. All right. You probably got plenty of words of advice for professionals who would like to work in this field. What would you like to share with them?
I think it's an incredibly interesting area of work and an incredibly important area of work. And when we think about, you know, the critical importance of workers being able to come home from work in the same state that they left work, that includes their psychological well-being as well as their physical health. So I'd really encourage people not to be afraid to use of working in this area, but to really help understand the role of the IHS generalist, that there are those things out there that helps define this is what their role is and then these are the places to go for help. And they don't need to be psychologists. They shouldn't even try to be psychologists. But what they can do is with absolutely within their domain of training and knowledge, skills and abilities, and that they can be really influential in organisations, in people's ongoing well-being and in managers' knowledge, skills and abilities as well.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Kirsten, it's been an amazing chat with you. You have such a wealth of knowledge over a couple of decades worth of work. So, and really great to see someone who hasn't just gone into academia and that's the only thing they've done. You've obviously got some really good practical experience as a consultant and in the regulator kind of environment as well. So amazing chat today.
It's been lovely to chat to you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we'll have to have you on at some point again in the future, I think, or maybe a master's student who's talking about competence.
Yeah,
maybe we'll have
to both that's you on together. Right.
Yeah.
That would be, yep.
So, that will bring us to the end of the show today, listeners. So don't forget, if you want to watch the video, and you can see Kirsten's lovely background that she's got today in lockdown in Brisbane, then check out the YouTube video on the Flourish DX channel. Also, if you want to see the 2 to 4 minute segments of gold that we pull from this longer format podcast, then you'll be able to check them out on the LinkedIn Flourish DX page. Joelle and I are active on LinkedIn, so if you want to follow us or connect with us, we'd be happy to continue the conversation online as well. And you'll be able to find Kirsten online as well as the AIHS. And we'll definitely link to some of these things that we've talked about today in the show notes. So thanks again, listeners, and we'll catch you next episode.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow Flourish DX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.